This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. The discovery of what appears to be an illegal Indonesian fishing camp on Australia's northern coast has shocked locals and raised questions about the adequacy of coastal patrols. There's been a surge in Indonesian crews entering Australian waters to harvest marine life, but this is the first evidence of them actually reaching the coast in recent years. For more, here's Erin Park from the National Regional Reporting Team.
When the ABC visited Niwollara Island in the remote North Kimberley last year, the national park was peaceful and pristine. The Guini traditional owners sampled bush fruits and helped archaeologists locate the remnants of seafood processing camps that were set up by visiting Asian fishermen in the 1800s.
In those days, some of our people used to talk the Indonesian way, talk in their language.
At that point, there was no hint of what was to come. A 21st century visit by Indonesian fishermen who appear to have entered the North Kimberley Marine Park earlier this year and set up camp on the island.
I've never ever seen them on the land or camping spots like this. This is obviously someone that's come in, set up camp for a week and dried their fish and then chuffed off again.
Steve Hinge and his wife discovered the campsite during a visit to Niwollara, also known as Sir Graham Moore Island, in May. The veteran skipper, who ran commercial fishing boats in northern waters for two decades, says it was a shocking sight.
In the corner there was a pile of rubbish, and it ended up being a lot of Indonesian products like water bottles, cigarettes, noodles and all sorts of things. And up on the rocks there was dried fish, a dried shark and various other bits and pieces to show that someone's spent a fair bit of time there, and I'd say they've probably been there, I don't know, maybe a week or so.
Steve Hinge reported the scene to federal authorities when they returned to shore and provided dozens of photos.
The authorities have obviously been doing a good job over the years keeping the illegal fishing and the incursions like this back, but there's obviously been a breakdown or there's a weakness in the system to have allowed this to occur. I mean, I did report it to the Border Force, but haven't heard anything back.
The number of Indonesian fishing boats illegally entering Australian waters has surged during the COVID pandemic, with tourism charters raising concerns about piracy and turtles found killed on remote atolls. But this is the first evidence of a crew reaching the Australian coast during the period. Local MP Neil Thompson says it shows worrying weaknesses in border security.
The challenge here is the number of boats that are starting to come down and the brazen activity that is going on along our coast. This is the problem because it poses such a huge biosecurity threat. It also impacts on our fragile and beautiful environment and it poses the national security risk. We must do more to stop this happening.
The Australian Border Force did not answer questions about the campsite but said in a statement that it coordinates regular patrols in the area. Steve Hinge is already planning his next northern voyage and is hoping surveillance will have improved.
Well, I mean, next thing you go down there, there'll be a few bits of tin and they'll be having a family there if we don't keep an eye on them. But I don't think we'll ever get to that level, but it is a concern and it's something that could grow quite easily if it's not clamped down pretty quick.
Boat skipper Steve Hinge ending that report from Erin Park. Already trained, ready to work, but staying home. Women with young children could be the workers needed to help tackle staff shortages. Ahead of the Jobs and Skills Summit, unions and advocacy groups are urging the federal government to speed up its planned changes to childcare to make that happen. Political reporter Stephanie Boris has more.
Breakfast is eaten, hair brushed, and the essential items are nearly in the backpack.
Ziggs, we'll put your hat in there and your jacket.
Canberra mum Marianne and her three-year-old son Ziggy are heading out.
All right, let's do it. Let's go to school. Let's go to daycare.
Like many families, Marianne decided not to work full-time because of childcare costs.
And when I went back to work, it just wasn't financially viable to go back more than 3 days. At the time, the subsidy cap meant that if I was going to be sending him a fourth and fifth day, most of my wage would be going to childcare.
From July next year, the federal government will increase the childcare subsidy rate and expand it to more families. But there are growing calls for those changes to come in sooner, in January, because of major work workforce shortages and rising cost of living pressures.
This is so urgently needed, particularly by working women.
Michelle O'Neill is the president of the Australian Council of Trade Unions.
So it's a critical issue about making sure that we increase women's participation. And then the other reason why it's so important is we have sectors of the economy saying that we have skill shortages.
Chief Executive Women, which represents hundreds of women in leadership roles, also want the childcare changes brought forward. Sue Morford is a non-executive director and says it will help close the gender pay gap.
And we know that these early childhood education and care reforms will make a significant difference to women being able to close the gap and develop their own sense of financial security and well-being.
An independent report issued earlier this year stated if the gap in participation rates and hours of paid work between men and women were halved, there'd be an additional 500,000 full-time equivalent workers.
It's a great policy a couple of years ago. It's an even more important policy today.
Thrive by Five Director Jay Wetherill is also pushing for the earlier introduction of the childcare subsidy changes.
Bring it forward. Because it will have dramatic effects on not only the economy, but on women and on our children.
However, the Treasurer and Early Childhood Education Minister have repeatedly cited cost as a reason for not doing that. Michelle O'Neill says that isn't a fair argument.
So if we lift women's workforce participation, then that money goes back into the economy. Those women pay tax. There's an advantage overall in terms of our economy if we have more women working.
Long-term, unions and advocacy groups are keen for the government to also get moving on its promise of nearly free childcare for all. The Morrison government did that during the pandemic. Marianne says it gave many women she knew the opportunity to work more.
It was amazing. I think there was like a general feel across all the mums I know that the fact that childcare was free just took all of the stress out of that choice of how much to work or not.
Canberra mum and part-time worker Marianne, ending that report by Stephanie Boris. Major transport companies and unions are lobbying the federal government to set a minimum wage for transport workers and reinstate a road safety regulator similar to the one axed by the coalition. Trucking companies and union leaders have met with the Workplace Relations Minister to discuss plans to reform the industry. It'd mean food delivery and rideshare drivers would be entitled to a minimum wage and rights regulated by an industry watchdog. Isabel Rowe reports.
Transport is Australia's deadliest industry. The Transport Workers Union says more than 260 truck drivers have died at work in the past 6 years, since a national safety regulator was abolished. Transport Workers Union Secretary Michael Kane says it should be returned.
We need an independent body in this sector to establish and maintain safe standards and standards that will ensure sustainability in this industry.
Union leaders and the industry have met in Canberra to reach an agreement backed by several major trucking companies, supermarkets Coles and Woolworths, and gig companies Uber and DoorDash. The body would resolve disputes, set and enforce industry safety standards, and allow workers a collective voice. Most importantly, Michael Kane says it'd set a minimum pay rate to prevent contractor truckies and food delivery drivers being forced to risk their safety.
There's so much commercial pressure that is brought to bear on companies and workers, and that's got to be taken care of, because otherwise workers are simply made to work too fast or too long, and that's a deadly recipe on our roads. And we want, you know, effective dispute resolution, making sure workers have a voice here.
The industry did have a regulator called the Road Safety Remuneration Tribunal. It was set up by the Gillard Labor government in 2012 and axed in 2016 by the Turnbull government after smaller operators complained a minimum pay standard would make their businesses unviable. Peter Anderson is the secretary of the trucking employer body, the Australian Road Transport Industrial Organisation.
Do we want another RSRC? No, that's the easy hook. That's the easy way to respond. No, we don't. We want something better.
The change would be significant for gig companies like Uber, where riders earn more by going faster and delivering more in shorter timeframes. Peter Anderson says if a national regulator disrupts that business model, so be it.
It isn't about how we can make people competitive if they're going to do nothing more than take away the wages of individuals. It's about saying, hang on a sec, we actually want our model to work. It may cost us 10, 20, 30% more than what we currently estimate, but that then should be the market price.
A spokesman for Uber says it supports the principles agreed to in yesterday's roundtable, including setting a minimum pay across the industry. The Federal Workplace Relations Minister Tony Burke will be asked to consider the proposal as part of possible changes to industrial relations rules to be discussed at this week's Jobs Summit.
Isabel Rowe reporting. Concerns are growing inside the Australian Army that a multi-billion dollar project for new infantry fighting vehicles could be dramatically scaled back or even scrapped. Soldiers say the upgrade is urgently needed to replace 60-year-old armoured personnel carriers, but critics believe defence should focus on other technology, like long-range missiles. Here's defence correspondent Andrew Green.
This is a Zero Alpha, a two enemy armoured vehicles.
Over the past 3 years, Army's been assessing the options for a new fleet of state-of-the-art land combat vehicles. Under Project Land 400 Phase 3, Defence will replace Vietnam-era M113 armoured personnel carriers with up to 450 new infantry fighting vehicles. But the Albanese government's recently announced Defence Strategic Review examining major military projects is casting doubt on the massive procurement.
If we don't upgrade the M113 and replace it with a newer system, which is the infantry fighting vehicle, we're condemning the infantry to fighting potential wars in the 21st century with 20th century capability. And frankly, I think the government's got to look long and hard if that's what they want.
Leo Purdy is a defence analyst and military historian. He's concerned the Land 400 Phase 3 project, which could cost up to $27 billion, will be scaled back to help fund expensive air and naval projects such as joint strike fighters and nuclear submarines. The former Lieutenant Colonel is urging the federal government to fully commit to the program well before the Defence Strategic Review is completed next year.
Given the pressures that inflation has provided to the budget, they're not going to go away anytime soon. So the longer this decision is delayed, you know, the potential for this program to, you know, cost more is there.
Not everyone agrees 450 new infantry fighting vehicles are needed for the Army. Michael Shoebridge is from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute and wants to see defence focus more on technology such as long-range missiles.
It already can't deploy any volume of the vehicles they already have and sustain them in our region.
If not 450, how many? None? Or somewhere in between?
The places where the ADF must fight are in our near region. When I look at that, I don't see a requirement for the Army to use its 75 Abrams tanks, its 200 combat reconnaissance vehicles, its 1,000 Bushmasters and its 1,000 Hawkeye vehicles and 450 infantry fighting vehicles.
Defence has declined to answer any questions on the topic except to say through a spokesperson that a recommendation on the preferred Land 400 Phase 3 tender remains on schedule to be considered by government this year.
Andrew Green. One third of Pakistan has been submerged by historic flooding. Roads, homes and crops have been washed away, with more than 30 million people affected. The country's climate ministers describe the situation as catastrophic. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
In Pakistan's Charsada region, residents are surveying the damage as the water recedes. Homes and crops have been inundated. People like Amir Khan saved what they could as the floods swept through.
When I saw the water coming, I evacuated the women and children. When I returned here, there was a lot of water, and then I saved the cattle. After that, there was no chance to return because there was so much water.
Ali Yan is one of tens of thousands of residents who were forced to flee their homes in northern Pakistan in recent days.
It was raining, but not heavily. Suddenly, the outer wall of the compound collapsed and water gushed in. We barely managed to save ourselves. By the time the women were leaving the house, the water had become almost waist deep.
Unprecedented monsoons have killed more than 1,100 people and have affected more than 30 million since mid-June. Roads, bridges and entire villages have been swept away. Pakistan's climate minister, Sherry Rehman, says her country is on the front line of a climate crisis.
Right now, one-third of Pakistan is underwater and 33 million are affected. Please tell me how that is not catastrophic. That is the size of a small country. There are many harrowing and heartbreaking scenes of trauma and distress. This is a huge humanitarian disaster, and I would call it quite apocalyptic.
For a country accustomed to monsoons, this is unlike anything they've seen, and more rain is expected in the next few weeks.
What we saw recently in the last 8 weeks is an unrelenting cascade of torrential rain that no monsoon has ever brought with it ever before. Pakistan is not unused to monsoons. We do expect them spread out usually over 3 months or 2 months, and they're sporadic monsoons, they're fairly strong, but the cycle is never, number one, without respite, nor is it in this volume and scale of water that comes down, neither is it so prolonged.
And the climate minister says the devastating flooding is just the latest in a series of disasters, including heat waves and forest fires, all exacerbated by climate change.
Clearly, we are in the front line of the ground zero of this crisis. And for us, it's been a catastrophe of unprecedented proportions. It's overtaken the 2010 floods in every sense of the word.
The damage bill is predicted to climb past $10 billion, but with many areas still inaccessible, it's only a rough estimate.
Alexandra Humphreys. The new colossal rocket ship NASA hopes will return humans to the moon remains grounded in Florida. Artemis was supposed to blast off on its first flight overnight, but the launch was scrapped due to an engine problem. Here's North America correspondent Carrington Clark.
Tens of thousands of people had flocked to the Space Coast in Florida, hoping to witness the launch of the rocket ship that will take humans back to the moon and beyond. But they were left disappointed.
We got up at 2 in the morning. We were out here by 3:45 waiting with the kids. And so now that it's not happening, it's just, you know, it just kind of sucks that we have to miss it.
What they were hoping to see was the debut flight of the Space Launch System. It's a giant, nearly 100-metre-high rocket, which NASA plans to use to take humans back to the moon and set the groundwork for an eventual journey to Mars. But just before it was due to be launched, a problem was identified with the cooling of one of the four engines, and the launch was scrapped. NASA Administrator Bill Nelson says he knows people are disappointed, but the organisation would be patient before it hit go on its multi-billion dollar rocket.
We don't launch until it's right. And I think it's just illustrative that this is a very complicated machine, a very complicated system, and all those things have to work. And you don't want to light the candle until it's ready to go.
The next possible date for launch is Friday local time, but Jonathan McDowell from the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics says for such a complicated launch, it might take a little longer to sort out all the kinks.
Is there another gremlin lurking in the works somewhere that's going to bite them as they get closer to T-minus zero? Or is the weather going to get them next time? And so, you know, it wouldn't be astonishing if they went on Friday, but it also wouldn't be surprising if they have a couple more attempts before they finally get off.
This first flight in the Artemis program will be an unmanned mission, mannequins taking the place of astronauts as a first step. The spacecraft, called Orion, is due to travel for 42 days, looping around the moon and then returning to Earth and splashing down into the Pacific. Astrophysicist Jonathan McDowell says today is just a slight hiccup in what will be an almost inescapable journey of humans to another planet.
It's really the next step in the evolution of life on Earth. It's not just humans that will be going, it's our entire biosphere. And it's a new ecological niche for terrestrial life to occupy. I think it's natural. I think the technology is here now, and it's basically inevitable that we'll do it.
Inevitable it might be, but first they need to get Orion off the ground. This is Carrington Clark in Washington reporting for AM.
And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. When a smooth-talking, politically connected businessman rolled into a small Australian suburb offering a quick turnaround investment, locals jumped at the chance. They ended up losing everything. Today, Four Corners reporter Caro Meldrum-Hannah on how she tracked down and confronted the man who promised the riches that never came. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.